We are hitting the road. From Marketplace, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer, in for David Brancaccio. We're just a few days away from the start of the summer travel season over Memorial Day weekend. It looks like it'll be a busy one. AAA expects more than 42 million Americans to take a trip of 50 miles or more. That's close to the record level set the year before the pandemic started. As Marketplace's Henry Epp reports, things could get especially busy at airports.
Expect long lines if you're headed to the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport over the holiday weekend, says spokesperson Perry Cooper.
We are one of the smallest airports by footprint in the country, so we are already having challenges with space and wait times.
Cooper says passengers should get there a few hours early. Same goes for pretty much every big airport, as AAA expects passenger numbers to exceed Memorial Day weekend records set in 2019. Airlines should be better prepared to meet demand than they were last summer. They've staffed up, but also cut back on flights, says AAA's Paula Twidale.
So you're going to have flights that are full, probably less selection and higher prices.
Despite those prices, people are still eager to spend on travel, says industry analyst Henry Hardeveldt with the Atmosphere Research Group.
What we know is that people have this sense of FOMO. They don't want to miss out on things.
They're choosing to take that big trip now, Hardeveldt says, because who knows what the future holds. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
President Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy are set to resume negotiations over the federal government's debt limit today. A default could happen in just weeks if nothing is done to raise or suspend the debt ceiling. Republicans are looking for spending cuts in exchange for raising the debt limit. One of their proposals is to tighten so-called work requirements for social safety net programs like food stamps and Medicaid. Work requirements are often traced back to the 1990s and the bipartisan welfare reform bill passed under former President Bill Clinton. But work requirements actually have a much deeper history. It's chronicled in a new season of Marketplace's investigative podcast, The Uncertain Hour. Chrissy Clark is the show's host and a senior correspondent here. She spoke with Marketplace's Nova Safo.
So tell me about the history of early work requirements in welfare programs. When did they come to be?
So let's take one of our earliest federal welfare programs, cash assistance for poor families, or what we commonly call welfare. It was created in the Great Depression under the New Deal. So the idea was that parents facing hardship, often widows, would get aid so they didn't have to work and could focus on raising their kids. But local welfare offices had a lot of power to decide who was, quote unquote, worthy of this kind of aid. And overwhelmingly at the time, that meant white families. And when one welfare official was asked why so few Black people got welfare, they said the welfare office didn't want to, quote, interfere with local labor conditions, and that Black mothers were expected to work, so they didn't need public assistance.
Wow, that's just chilling. So implicit work requirements for some people along racial lines, but still not officially mandated work requirements for everyone. When did that start?
Well, fast forward to the early 1960s, and the welfare rolls have started to grow across all races. But what really gets attention is that there's a growing share of Black families who are receiving welfare, and this is for a lot of reasons. For one thing, white women actually start leaving the welfare rolls because there's a new, more generous safety net that opens up for them. The upshot is the percentage of families on the welfare rolls who are Black more than doubles from 1940 to 1960. And this is right in the time when we start hearing some of the first rhetoric around the problems of welfare and some really forceful calls for putting work requirements into the program, like from this guy.
We challenge the right of freeloaders to make more on relief than when working. And we challenge the right of people to quit jobs at will and go on relief like spoiled children.
This is the city manager of Newburgh, New York, and that's one of the first places that experimented with putting welfare work requirements into welfare in the early 60s. And this guy, Joseph Mitchell, claims that a wave of Black families from the South is moving to his city to loaf on welfare and avoid work. And he blames them for many of the city's economic problems. His claims are debunked, and the work requirements he tried to create get rolled back. But his campaign to put work requirements into welfare got traction all the same.
And how does all of this connect to the work requirements we have in cash welfare today?
So those were created in the bipartisan 1990s welfare reform bill. And the arguments for them still had undercurrents of these racist tropes around so-called welfare queens and things like that. But some of the focus at that point had shifted to this idea that welfare had become a trap, and that work requirements were all about helping people find jobs and, quote, self-sufficiency. And yet, since the 90s, study after study has found that most work requirement compliance-based programs are, to quote one study by Mathematica, mostly not effective at improving the economic independence of welfare participants.
Chrissy Clark, host of Marketplace's investigative podcast, The Uncertain Hour, which dives much more deeply, by the way, into this topic and the welfare-to-work industrial complex that's developed. I highly recommend you listen. It's available at marketplace.org and wherever you get your podcasts. Chrissy, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Nova.
I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Hey, everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.